United States v. Hopkins. Mr. Foster.
Please the court. My name is Jim Foster, counsel. It's a limited area that I've brought before this court, and that is specifically to what extent did the court need to address the statutory factors brought up by the defense at sentencing. There was a guilty plea, there was an expert witness presented, and our position is that the court failed to address any of the statutory pleas brought forward by the defense. The memorandum that was filed in front of the court pointed out several matters, as did the sentencing hearing point out several matters. Included within those was the marginal deterrent effect. We cited to the court Newsom. Included within those was the treatability issue. We cited to the court the U.S. Miranda decision. Included within those was the treatability as it protected the public. We cited the Miranda. And the case ended basically with the court giving the following indication that the court will only sentence outside the guidelines in unusual cases for clearly identified and persuasive reasons. The defendant's request for the advisory guideline is not persuasive, and the court determines in its discretion not to do such. We believe that the court by not addressing the issues brought forward, we think that the record in front of this court, that this court cannot tell why the trial district court rejected the pleas. The government opines that the district court did not like the expert. The government opines that the district court did not find the expert persuasive. That may well be, but no one here will ever know that. The defendant will never know that. The reviewing court will never know that.
How else would you take the fact that he just rejected it totally?
As argued, one way to take it is that he put too much emphasis on the guidelines. In the Cunningham case, and we all agree on certain precedent, he doesn't have to write a short story on every issue we bring up. But in the Cunningham case, it was made clear that the district court has to give a record that permits the reviewing court to know that the district court properly exercised its discretion. And Cunningham also said, which we think is very important, that a judge who fails to mention a ground of recognized legal merit is likely to have committed error. Now, treatability has been recognized in Miranda. It's been recognized in Newsom. The marginal deterrence argument's been recognized in Newsom. These were not surprises. It was not a surprise that the defense was relying only on the statute. The guidelines were a given. And in this particular case, Gall has rejected straight out any extraordinary emphasis that one has to give to the statutory factors. Nelson, I think, is very important. In Nelson's case, the court used the word presumptive. The court used the words that the guidelines are considered presumptively reasonable, but the court in Nelson, the district court, said, unless there's a good reason to follow the statutory sentencing factors, the guidelines are reasonable. That is very close to what happened in this case. The only explanation of the defendant's position on his sentence was the court's indication that it only applies the guidelines. It says, in exercising its discretion, this court will only sentence outside the guidelines in unusual cases. I'm submitting, the defense submits that violates Gall. The Nelson language. It's in our position. We believe that when one has put all their apples in the statutory discretion, the guidelines were admitted, the guidelines were given. Everybody who commits this particular offense of receiving pornographic material, who has over 600 images, if they contain certain things, the guidelines are a given. They're there. They're in concrete. In this case, the defense applied to the district court for an expert. They presented that expert. They presented a doctor in psychology. The doctor in psychology opined that the minimum mandatory was sufficient for her treatment. Now, I'm not trying to turn her into the sentencing judge, but...
Well, that's the problem. It seems to me that, in this case, the district judge said he didn't buy her... That was her practice, was treating sexual offenders. But on cross-examination, I think, the witness acknowledged the defendant currently maintained a sexual interest in children.
Obviously. We cannot contest that. The person, now that was not his only sexual period interest, if you will. There was multiple images. Nobody can clean up the filth that's out there on the internet. And we read every day about people being addicted to it. And yes, it's disgusting. It's filthy. So did he have an interest in children? Yes, he did. Was there any evidence that he had out and out had one-on-one contact? No. On the marginal deterrence theory, if we give the statutory maximum or within 3 months of the statutory maximum to everyone who possesses, what then do we do with those who also take the pictures, who also molest while they're possessing the pictures? And I can't substitute the treatment provider's judgment, but what I believe the defendant was entitled to was to know whether the trial court was just wedded to the guidelines or whether the trial court indeed rejected the treatment provider that this particular defendant presented. And I think this court, under Cunningham, I think it's the duty of the district court to send a record that permits this court to determine that the trial court sufficiently exercised its discretion. And I think to sufficiently exercise your discretion, you have to minimally consider theories that are brought to you that have been acknowledged in the past. And I don't see how a court can take the Miranda decision, where this court put its seal of approval on the treatability argument, and it said treatability can indicate that it's not necessary to segregate the defendant in order to protect society. I believe that we know that the trial court has a right in its discretion, if it exercises that discretion, to reject that. But can they just in silence send the defendant home and say, I only apply these when there's a persuasive argument, I found this unpersuasive? That's our argument, that it's inappropriate to do it in that sort of summary fashion.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Foster. Ms. Berkowitz?
May it please the Court, Diane Berkowitz of the United States. The case law is very clear, and counsel has cited Cunningham. If the argument that the defendant puts forward, and it is the burden of the defendant to put forward the argument and present the evidence if he is seeking an below-guideline sentence, that it have some merit. And in this case, it did not. It did not have merit, and under the case law...
But the judge's treatment of the issue is uniquely perfunctory. I mean, it looks like, you know, boilerplate. It doesn't look as if he actually addressed any of the issues.
But there are no issues to really address, Your Honor, because the argument the defendant said he was going to present evidence on is that the defendant was treatable, that he was not a danger to others, and that there were defendants with similar backgrounds who received lower sentences. The defendant did not deliver on that promise. What he presented was a very inexperienced...
Well, the judge could have said that, right? But it's hard to tell from what he said on what basis he rejected the...
The court could have said that, Your Honor, but in Cunningham, this court has...
It's one sentence what he said. Right?
If you
do a little better. I mean, this is a very long sentence. You'd think he could... He says, all he says is... A below-guidelines range sentence is not warranted under the facts and circumstances of this case. He doesn't say what any of the relevant facts and circumstances are.
But, Your Honor, I'm really not sure that it would be necessary, too, because the defendant's own expert stated on the record and in her report that people who don't receive incarceration oftentimes are not amenable to treatment, and they don't make much progress.
She wasn't arguing that he not be incarcerated. She was arguing for a lower sentence. I don't understand.
And without stating a basis for a lower sentence, Your Honor.
Well, why didn't he say that? No basis for it. He just brushed it off without any discussion whatsoever.
But when you look at this court's reasoning in Cunningham, when the court has said if there's not merit in the argument defendants presented, there's
for the sake of judicial economy.
Look,
if it's frivolous, if it's obviously lacking in merit, but why is it obvious? Why is it obvious to an outsider like us or other judges that the person may be treatable and therefore with a lower sentence and treatment in prison, maybe that reduces his recidivism likelihood to some tolerable level? I don't know why a judge couldn't spend a couple of more sentences discussing why he rejects that theory.
But there's nothing stated as to, first of all, the defense expert specifically stated that she has no evidence, no history, no documentation that would support a determination as to whether or not this defendant would in fact be treatable and or whether or not
he would reoffend. That he's treatable. Now you say, well, she has no evidence to back it up. Well, the judge could have said that, no evidence to back it up. All he uses is this boilerplate, facts and circumstances. We don't have any idea what he's thinking about. It doesn't matter whether these people are treatable.
Defendant's expert specifically stated that there is no, based on her training and experience, there is nothing that she can do to determine whether or not any defendant with these issues, including this defendant, would reoffend. She makes a very, she is emphatic.
Doesn't know either, right? So nobody knows.
She was making a different sort of a presentation. She administered a battery of psychological tests specific to this sort of an offender, as I understand the record.
That's correct,
and
Your
she
Honor.
Offered an opinion that this defendant was treatable and that a moderate period of incarceration followed by lifetime supervision would be an appropriate sentence, and the district court dismissed it out of hand in a single sentence. And if we accept that, then we're basically saying as a matter of law, this kind of psych eval in a case like this is irrelevant and frivolous to present, and the judge can safely ignore it. That can't be the right legal outcome, regardless of whether this is an appropriate sentence or not.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, but one of the tests that the expert did administer to the defendant was a psychological test that the defendant, in fact, was deceptive on. So her representation that he was amenable to treatment, she even acknowledged, was not entirely...
There may be many, many ways to undermine this testimony and her report and her work, but the bottom line is the judge didn't grapple with any of that or articulate a basis for rejecting her testimony. He just rejected it out of hand.
And the government would take the position that there are instances, and this would certainly be one, where the court does not have to necessarily...
Not when you're talking about expert testimony in a case like this. I mean, that would be an extraordinary legal argument to make, that a judge can, in one sentence, dismiss expert testimony on a psychological evaluation like this. Is there any other context in which a judge can dismiss expert testimony in a single sentence?
Only, Your Honor, and this is the position the government takes, where there is no merit to the testimony, where it does not support the position or the arguments the defendant is attempting to articulate for
but
purposes of
But then the judge
his.
Has to say why it doesn't support that, right?
But again,
and provide a basis for rejecting the expert's testimony. You can't do it without stating any reason at all.
Again,
we have nothing to review.
Again, Your Honor, the government would refer to Cunningham, in which this court has said if the argument is without merit, and for the sake of judicial economy, the court should that the argument should be passed over in silence.
What about his argument about marginal deterrence, that this sentence is so stiff that people in this position might as well, you know, go hog wild? There's no additional deterrent effect of a higher sentence for people who offend more.
Actually, there is, Your Honor. The defendant received a sentence of 210 months. the maximum under the guideline analysis would have been 262 months.
What is the statutory maximum?
That's correct. It's a 20-year statutory maximum. But we're talking about 8,000 pictures of child pornography.
240 months, you're saying, is the statutory maximum.
20 years would be the statutory maximum.
You got 210.
Correct.
So that 30, in your view, that extra 30 months is adequate to deal with all the larger offenders? Or is your view that this is the maximum offense? What about the people who take the photographs? Do they get a higher sentence than the 20 years?
Conceivably, they would, Your Honor.
How so? Under what statute?
Your Honor, I don't know what statute.
How do you know then there are sentences higher than 20 years for these people?
I don't know, Your Honor. I said conceivably they would.
Conceivably?
Conceivably.
Well, if a defendant argues to a judge, look, this sentence is unreasonable because it doesn't preserve any margin for punishing worse offenders more heavily, doesn't the judge have to address that?
Well, in this case, Your Honor,
just saying conceivably there might be a higher sentence for those people?
In this case, you have a defendant with 8,000 photographs. You have a defendant who set up a server. He set up a server.
Look, there are two types of these pornography offenders. One of these, the people who download and upload images that they get from other people. And the others are the ones who actually create the images, which is regarded as, I would think, properly as a more serious crime. They're the ones who actually create the materials which then circulate. So these people are important criminals because they are creating a market for the photographs. But the people who are producing the photographs, well, without them, you don't have anything. So
this defendant did acknowledge, Your Honor, that he was on webcams. He did use webcams to engage in sexual activity. Not only did he watch them, but he used webcams to engage in sexual activity. Based on the facts
so
of his case.
Are you saying he uploaded photographs that he took into the web?
I don't know that we can say that, but what we can say based on the facts is that the defendant acknowledged.
Well, that might be significant, right? Because it's the people who upload into the web who are creating this circulating, you know, medium of pornographic pictures.
But you have this defendant acknowledging that he has acknowledged this.
Do you think this is at least worth another sentence by the judge?
Your Honor, it would have been possible that the court could have articulated more detail on its sentence.
More detail? There's no detail. Why do you say more detail? That implies there's some detail and there could have been more detail. Where's the detail?
Your Honor, the court did address the 3553 factors. And to that extent, there is.
He just recited them. He didn't address them. He just recited them. This sentence may be quite justifiable. The problem is that the judge didn't say anything to justify it. I mean, if he had said all the things that you're saying here today, we might not have this appeal.
Well, it's clear that Judge Moody didn't believe. He didn't believe the expert's testimony. He didn't articulate particularly why he didn't believe it. He's obviously didn't.
Okay, thank you, Ms.
Berkowitz. Thank you, Your
Honor. Mr. Foster, how much time does he have? 3 minutes?
Thank you. In addition to what the defense tried to present to the court in this matter was in the pretrial sentencing submission, we put forth the Miranda case, we put forth the Newsom case, and we tried to present specifically to the court that we were going, and in Cunningham it was diminished mental capacity. In this case, it was treatability. Miranda, it was treatability. There were other things involved here also. You had a 41-year-old male homosexual, no prior criminal history, 2 master degrees, who had been a viable member of society since a very young person, had a job making $60,000 to $80,000 a year.
That's not an uncommon profile in these offenses.
Regrettably, it's not. But I think, again, that's where, not to belabor an issue, but I think that's where the marginal deterrence comes. As we read more and more about this, we find out that there's all the levels of culpability that violates the self-same statute. From cases out of this district where there was molestation going on with the pictures. And so all I'm pointing out is we had a different level of culpability, if it's permissible to say such. And I think it is, because we have such a huge sampling group of people who violate this statute that I think we have to weigh their culpabilities. With this particular person, there was other things that were brought to the court's attention that were not responded to at all. The three cases in the sentencing memorandum, now we didn't belabor it on appeal, we didn't belabor it there. We brought to the court's attention three other sentences in the district court where 10 years had been applied. And it was also in the Newsom case where it said it's appropriate after Booker to weigh other sentences. We brought to them the Lohan, the McNeely case, and the Rocheland case in our sentencing memorandum. All cases where there had been contact with people where 10 years had been. So I think we came very close when you have an unrebutted expert testimony and nothing offered.
Do you think the government had offered expert testimony? Could Judge Moody have just chosen between the two?
Well, clearly, I think so. I mean, I guess we could all imagine the type of case where expert testimony was so outside of the area that you could disregard it, but I find it hard to conceive of right now. If you have two experts presented, I think it's clearly up to the court to decide which one of those experts. But I also, under the Cunningham case and the Miranda case, think that it's necessary for the trial court to tell you folks, as well as telling the defense, why it has rejected one of those experts, or at least to say I've picked expert one.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Foster. And Ms. Berkowitz, and Mr. Foster, you were appointed, so we thank you for your efforts on behalf of the